Thank you. My name is Clint Hodges. I'm an alcoholic. And I was very touched as I sat there and saw the chip and the cake given. Very touched by what this program does for us. Yeah, I have been around long enough to have people in this room that I go way back with. And there has, I just am so aware tonight of the fact that we grow here. We are transformed here. We come here, a miracle has taken place in our lives, and we don't even know it. And until we get that, we're sober, but we're sort of brash and a little frantic. Afraid and cocksure at the same time. And slowly over time we settle down. And so it was a privilege to sit here and see my friend Pat give cakes one after the other. And in a deeply moving way demonstrate his love for these guys. And to be with Dave tonight at dinner. Linda and Dave and I had dinner together. And we've all changed over the years. We've quieted down a little bit. We have come to know that we're safe. To see my friend Cliff and his family members to I think that I puzzled for some time over why on earth this business of anonymity would have such immense spiritual significance, as it says in the traditions, tradition 12, because it started out in a way that I understand. When the preface to the first edition of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was written, they said, we're going to stay anonymous here because we are too few at present to handle the onrush of business that's going to be created out of this book. This is our avocation. This is not what we do for a living. We got businesses to tend to and families to feed and children to raise and homes to maintain, and we don't want to be crushed by the avalanche of people that will come to us for help if they knew who we were. And that's exactly what that paragraph says. And that was written in 1939. And in 1946, the 12 traditions were formalized, and as you know, they were presented at Cleveland to a convention of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1950 and ratified the next year. And by that time, in 7 years, from 39 to 46 when they were written, and five more years till 51 when they were ratified, they talked like the tradition of anonymity is of immense spiritual significance. It goes from, we're anonymous because we can't be kept from our jobs, to the principle of anonymity has an immense spiritual significance. And I wondered, how the hell did they get there? What is that? And it strikes me that in my own progress, and I've been sober since August of 1966, my friend Ed Lynch and I go way back. My claim to fame is that his bail bondsman was my bail bondsman. Man, that'll give you a sense of connectedness out there. And Ed and I are still doing great. I kicked over 3 cups of coffee tonight, and he cleaned up every damn one of them. And he feels quiet and good. And so I felt a lot of love up here, which is a very, very powerful thing. And if you're new here tonight or in your first few months of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's hard to kind of get it. That doesn't register. Something's going on and we can't quite get it. Then it's love. It's love. We feel something weird and we can't quite get it. And that's reality. We're oddly, we're people who need to know we're alive. And somehow booze gave us that, didn't it? And you take the booze out of the picture, and how am I going to know I'm alive? Some of us know we're alive because we've stirred up trouble that day. Some of us know we're alive because we have gotten a high drama going out of an insignificant detail in our life. Some of us, this is my personal favorite, know we're alive when we're breaking the law by about 20 miles an hour on the freeway. Which is why I leave a little later than I should every time so I can get out there and show that I'm alive. But we come to know that we're alive, that there is a presence and a power that is with us all the time, whether we have asked for that or not, it's there. And the only thing that happens is sometimes we get it. Sometimes we're sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I was tonight, very aware of the power in this room, very aware of the fact that miracle after miracle after miracle got up here and took a chip or took cake. And we all celebrated that. We all rejoiced with that. Not because some remarkable achievement had been made, but because each of these people has, by that time and that moment of honoring their transformation and their progress, has said, "Okay, I'm on the path. I'm on the right track." This kind of an experience is what Wilson referred to in that. In Bill's story, he talks about going to England at the beginning of World War I. He was a young artillery officer, and the First World War was on, and American troops were trained and sent overseas, and he and his battery and whoever else wound up in London, and they were kind of welcomed. And booze was part of the picture, and they were taken around. They wound up at Winchester Cathedral. And he says, "I was in that cathedral," and he just dismisses the whole thing with a very brief sentence, and you almost miss it. He says, "Much moved, I wandered outside." But at page 12 or 13, he's in Towns Hospital. Many years has gone by. And he has had his last drink, and he is struggling with this whole thing and has no idea, of course, at that time, that he's going to one day soon meet a guy named Bob Smith, and Alcoholics Anonymous will come out of that meeting. But he had a remarkable experience in the hospital, one of these transformative experiences where he was touched by God in such a way that nothing less would ever do for him. And he said the meaning of the experience in the cathedral was clear to me for the first time. For a brief moment I had wanted God and was humbly willing to have him with me, and he came. But soon the awareness of his presence was blotted out by the clamor of worldly things, mostly those within myself, and so it had been ever since. But he had that sweet cathedral experience. And we've all had the cathedral experience. We've had it. We're seekers. We've been touched in such a way that nothing less will ever do. And I sat in this meeting tonight and was, because of the power of the program, because of my awareness of the miracles that had taken place that were just manifest up here, humbly willing to have God with me, and he was there, as he always is. And I've been looking for that all my life. And I had... no idea 29 years ago when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, when Ed Lynch's bail bondsman brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he did, that I would be here, that I would be witness to the remarkable things that take place in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and amongst its members. And so we know this. We know, whether we're around here a half a year or 25 years, we know that two things. We know that God is love, and we know that God works through people. And if you're new, relatively new, and you get a little taste of this business of being loved, this taste of the idea that somebody cares about you and doesn't seem to want anything back, you know that that's powerful business. And if you know that God works through people, that kind of a feeling comes through another human being, as a rule. And so I say, I love you. And it may not be that way. It may be that God is loving you through me. And if that's the case, and I want to have that kind of power in my life and let it come through me, all I have to do is show up and drop my objections to whatever is going on and allow God to love you through me. And it stops being me. I don't say, I love you. I say that, but I know that something else is happening. And I think that's the essence of this anonymity thing. I think that's why it has such immense spiritual significance, because nothing that we do for one another is really our power. Our power accomplishes nothing but living our lives in such a way that we're relatively free of blockage allows power to come through us. That is enormously useful to another human being. Now, that's all pretty fancy business and kind of theoretical and a little bit out there. but I'm having fun with it, so to hell with it. And if it is supposed to be a workshop and we have some time constraint, at some point prior to 9:30 we stop and ask for questions. That's the deal tonight? 9:20 we stop, all right. So how do we get to this? Let me just tell you briefly that when Ed's bail bondsman caught up with me in 1966, I was living in a garage in Glendale, California, with three other guys. It was a double garage and been broken up into little rooms. Condo arrangement, I think. And I had a sweetheart of a room, I'll tell you that. It smelled good in there, as well, mattresses always do. And the hot summer, August, July and August of 66 was particularly, there was a bouquet, boy, that just brought tears to your eyes. And the linoleum floor was sticky, and there was a radio with a clock in it that it was weird. That clock radio is a weird thing at a time like that because, number one, you look at it at 4 in the morning, and it's 4, and then you wait an hour, and you look again, and it's 4:07. So the time is wrong on those things. And the other thing is that it'll play music long after you pull the plug out of the wall. You can kind of hear it there. It's like you can hear the people that gather outside the garage to talk about you. Whispering. Just, you can't quite get what they're saying, but they're there. What was that? I didn't have any, I had the cot, there was some, a little bit of clothing in a wardrobe chest there, and that was about it. There was a bulb coming out of the ceiling. There was a old copy of Playboy magazine in there. My social life. Honey, I'm home, you know, it's one of those. So it was a full and rich life, and I don't know why I was dissatisfied with it. And Ed's bail bondsman, a guy named Don, had given me a job selling encyclopedias door to door. He came from rich experience in that area. He sold photo albums on new baby leads. Those were always great. You go knock on the door and you say, I understand you have a new baby and I'm here to sell you the photo. It's a total scam. You give them the photos for free, but the album itself costs $1,200. And here's what kind of a guy he was. If she'd say, I don't want any photographs, he'd say, all right, what's wrong with the baby? And he was a bad man. And he brought me to AA. He did. And I've called him on my birthday every year since that time. He brought me in July, and I got sober in August. I had my last drink in August. And I call him. For the first few years, it was always a lot of fun because he... I'd say, hey, Don, it's Clint Hodges. And he'd say, yeah, Clint, where are you now? And I think if you're new here, I will simply tell you that one of the most touching things I know about Alcoholics Anonymous is that by the time that first year had come around and he asked me that question, where are you now? I could give him an answer. I knew where I was, and I could say it out loud from a pay telephone in LA. In our group, one of the promises is you'll come to know your full name and address, and some of us do. And so he brought me here, and so I had a beginning in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my first year and second year and third year and early years were frantic, as everyone's is. It's either internally frantic or we do a lot of acting out and all of that stuff, and it's just the way that it is. It takes us a while to calm down. We have no idea that we've been given a gift. We think we have something to earn. We think we somehow, I don't know what I could have, what I did that night on the 14th of August, 1966, when I had my last drink, but I know I didn't do anything to earn the gift that I got. I think I begged for the gift. I think I implored in some way a power that's much greater than me for peace, for surcease, for an end to this. And I don't know how I said it, our prayers are often profane. They sometimes don't sound anything like prayers. But we say them. And something happens to us at that point. There is a God who gave me that gift 29 years ago. I knew, I've always known I didn't do it. I didn't quit. We don't quit. It's not about quitting. If you're new here, do not think you have to quit, because you know and I know you can't quit. Haven't you already tried that and it hasn't worked out too well? If you could do it, you wouldn't be here. Jesus, who would come here? You just quit. And so we're a collection of people that can't quit. If you can quit, you don't need this. If you can't quit, that's what this is. You remember when the steps were read here tonight, and it said step one, and then it gave a little drill? If it were about quitting, wouldn't it say step one, quit? Come on now, knock it off, God. It doesn't say that. It says step one, you are toast. You better get that you are toast. And it's the beginning, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, they say it elegantly. They say things like powerless and unmanageable. Came to believe, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. And there's this hope, even when we get that, yeah, you're right, I'm powerless, I can't control that stuff, I can't stay away from it, and when I start, I'm gone. And boy, my life is sure unmanageable around booze. And there's this hope, this assumption, this feeling within all of us, that now that the booze has been taken out of my life, now that I've been given this gift, my life will somehow become manageable. By God, by the time I'm 5 years sober, I will have pulled it together. I've never been able to before, but somehow I will know how to act and work and earn and save and whatever, you know. I'll even quit smoking. I don't care. Okay. I was kind of shocked to find out that the manageability doesn't settle back in. Uh, And then you know with certainty that if I win the lottery, my life will become manageable. Now, if she'd get off my back, or on my back, whatever. I don't even know what that means, but I like it. And then the day comes, whether we're 2 years or 5 years or 25 years sober, and we get it one day. Oh, I'm manageable. Oh, you mean I'm not only powerless over booze, but I can't manage my life. Now we can get going. I've been going to meetings, and I've been doing this, and I've been doing that. Finally, the penny drops. Oh, unmanageable. Oh, Jesus, why didn't you say that? You mean I don't have any power? Oh, I know it says there is one who has all power, but God, he can't have it all, can he? Isn't there some for me? Just like that illusion that I had somehow chosen the drink just because I ordered it. I didn't choose anything. I just found the drink right there. Remember? Quitting until the drink is right there. You're in the bar and it's a double right there. You go, God, damn, I wonder how that got there. But at least when we get it, and it takes whatever that takes. It takes some rough sledding in AA, usually, for us to get it. Or we know it for a little while at first, and then we forget. We somehow think, I did that. I just did everything. See, this is about power. It's about power and lack of power. And we get that we don't have any power, and we don't like that much. My ego says, I don't think that's right. And we're power seekers. We care about power. Lack of power is not a dilemma unless you care about power. There's some people here in Carlsbad tonight that don't care about power. None of them in this room, but they... Oh, we're all so casual and knocked back about it, but we look under every rock we can for power. We love to take those seminars, don't we? The ones that promise us the one thing that we really need. That they'll show us how to get our own way. I love those. I have a friend that says he's on the path, and there's a sign up that says, down this road is a two-headed calf. He goes down the road. He likes to see the two-headed calf. I like that too. If there's a seminar down there that says, this is how, walk on top of this building on a bed of fire. Do a fire walk. That'll prove something. We don't know what, but by God, that'll make a difference. Sure, I'll go do a fire walk. What do I care? Give me a two-headed calf and a crippled monkey, and man, I go for it. Because AA is too simple and straightforward. But we come back on the path, and we do the deal, and we stay here because it's the best game in town for us, and we love it, and we have so much fun with the unity and the service and the doing for others. And we're kind of circling back to the thing that we always wanted, and that is to be useful. But we're not very good at it in the sense of the long haul. We're not, it's like we have this notion, most of us, I do, and a lot of the people I know, that if I want that cathedral experience, I want that sense of connectedness with God and with my fellow man, exemplary, and can do it long enough, God will notice and he will help me. And it isn't true. It isn't true. It isn't that he won't notice. It isn't that he can't help me. It's simply that one of the pieces is missing, and the piece is this. I have to invite him in. I have to ask him to help me. And when I invite him in, as I did in August of 1966, in whatever profane way I did, he helps me. He just handles it. And I have to get to that point where I say, things are just... there's something in me, there's a meanness in me, there's a liar in me, there's a thief in me, there's a cheat in me. I cannot live this life in any comfort. Take these things out of it and give me peace. Give me the capacity to do the thing I've never had the capacity to do, and that is to have compassion for that peace in me that's never going to get it. What have I done to love the broken part? And this is such a great playground for that. We come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's a new guy in here, and he's a stinker, and nobody wants to be around him. Except we spot him, and we go, hey, how you doing? And we have some compassion for the broken part. And when we, and the guy at first smells and feels like our enemy, like he's dangerous, he'll do something. You know, we all feel, guy comes to a meeting with booze on his breath, and man, whew, you imagine a guy with a drinking problem coming here? We don't go for that shit around here, boy. But Thomas Merton said an interesting thing. He said that when I extend my hand to my enemy, God reaches out to both of us. I'm going, yeah. Yeah. What if the enemy is inside? What if that piece of me that won't quit smoking, that I hate? One day we extend. What if it's that drunk in there that I hated so much? I extend my hand to that drunk because you taught me how to do that, and God reached out for both of us, and that drunk stopped causing trouble. And I've lived a sober life all these years because I've been given a gift, and I have, it's a weird gift. I have the rest of my life to become comfortable with the gift. Because you take alcohol away, and I'm kind of like in new territory, and it isn't comfortable. And that's why these meetings are so sweet and so precious. And for a while we come here because we have to. And then sooner or later we notice that the piece that's missing may be located somewhere in those steps. I've done the service, and I've done the unity, the fellowship, the home group, and the, all of it. What about the steps? What about that psychic change that Silkworth talked about? What about that mind of mine that seems to have so much trouble? I get a moment, a cathedral experience in a meeting, and on the way home, somebody cuts me off, and man, who in this room has had somebody hang up the phone on them? They have to die, don't they? I mean, it's like... There's a mind that'll take you around the block a time or two, you know. We don't have any proportion. Can't think straight. Got an ego that'll assume a stupid position and defend it to the bitter end. There's a combination. We're never at peace. Long after the booze is taken out of our life, we'll get moments of peace. And what am I going to do with that? Silkworth says, I need an entire psychic change. I need a new mind. That old mind is not going to get it done, and it needs to be replaced. with another mind, another way of looking at things, another set of, not perception so much, but intuitive thought. I mean, I can't take that mind out and shop it around enough psychiatrists to really matter much. I can't sprinkle enough Prozac on that baby to really help, you know? So what am I going to do with that? What about those flat spots? What about that time at 6 years or 12 or 18 years of sobriety when it's like, oh, I don't know. These steps are such amazing things because at step one, if we really get that we're powerless, unmanageable, at least we know where we are. And at step two, if we really come to believe that there is a power greater than we are that'll take us to sanity, we know where we want to go. And so if I'm here and I know I want to go here, how am I going to get there? And that's where step three comes along, because I have always wanted to get here, but I've always kind of circled the drain over here. Drunk and sober. How am I going to get here? By my own effort. I never stopped trying since I was 5 years old, so I know that I will not be able to do that. I better tap into some power. I better be willing, finally and at last, to say whatever and turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And we all have good reasons why we won't do that. I do. I know that my uncle got saved in the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana, and they sent him to China to be a missionary, and I don't want to take step three, man. I don't want to go to China. And it strips me of this opportunity that I desperately want to have my own way. That's all an alcoholic ever wants, to get his own way. And then when we get it, we are not happy with it. And so what do? We blame them, whoever they are. And so I want to then, if I really turn my will, my life over the care of God, as I understand God, I need to notice that there's some obstacles in my path. And I take an inventory, the purpose of which is to form a new attitude, a new relationship with my Creator, and to discover the obstacles in the way. And I looked at all those old ideas, those character defects, and I looked to see if I'm still interested in them, and usually by that time I'm not. And I make a list of those, and I ask for willingness to have them taken out of my life. And we're at step six, and I am willing. And willing is interesting because it means gladly ready. Gladly ready. That's what willing means. I always thought willing means done to the head time, you know. It doesn't mean that. It means I have to ask God to take me to a state of being gladly willing to have my lust removed. Well, how about helping me get rid of some of my lust? Because we think our sex life will suffer if the lust is out of our lives. Isn't that interesting? And all it means, lust, all it means is I am trying to use sex as a way of getting power. Because I gotta have power. And so I misuse sex. Not because of this particular event or that particular event or this preference or that, but because of what I want from it. I want something that isn't in it. I want power out of it. And when I give that up, I don't lose anything. Because I never could get power out of it. And the loving is different from the But we're afraid. We're afraid. We don't know that on this side of it. That business of stepping from the bridge of reason to the shore of faith, remember that language? Wilson drives me nuts with that language. It's like one time in his story, he says, for several months, the goose hung high. What the hell does that mean, Bill? And then he talks about stepping from the bridge of reason to the shore of faith. Like, will I step into the abyss? Am I willing to really let go of all my old ideas? Am I really willing? And then you look at it a different way and you say, that just simply means if I'm on the bridge of reason, I'm coming from what I know. And if I'm going to step to the shore of faith, I'm going to have to go into areas I don't know, which is where we want to play anyway. And so I step from what I know to what I don't know. And we don't like to play there, but I'll tell you, that's a sweet place to play, and I'll tell you why. If I'm always coming from what I know, I'm coming inevitably from my past, and I project it into the future. And I call it reality, and it isn't anything. It's just more of the past, and what it really means is my life is going to be eternally filled with the past, which means I have only the past. I don't have a future. And I can't take this moment and hold it sweet. And when we let go of that stuff, it takes power to do it. And the power to take step 7 comes from step 6. And the power from six comes from 5. And the power for 5 comes from 4, and so on. And finally we get on the road and we make amends. And that can be transforming. We kneel at graves we never thought we would kneel at. And we talk to people that we cannot talk to. And healing and loving become part of our lives. And new experiences can come in. And we never do get our own power. But if we can stand to live a life that has more power in it than we ever thought, but it is not our power, we can begin to take off our pack and rejoice here in this meeting this night to see old friends, to see new people, to see a chip and cakes, to see men and women transformed by the power of this program and these steps into vital, responsible, active, productive human beings. The failures of this world have, by their failure, by their willingness to say, I have no power, stumbled into real power, the power that comes through us, this love that comes through us, so that we're never the same again. Thanks.